Let's welcome Janice Lee.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Steve, again, and thank you, Brenda. So I'm going to read all from this new novel that I've just finished called Imagine a Death. And just like a little bit of story about the origin of this novel, because Brenda's cat has a very huge part to play in this. But I was having a lot of trouble trying to figure out how to start this book, and I had to stay with Brenda and have her cat, Mr. Bungy, talk to me in my sleep and then follow me home and arrive at my house in a dream in order for this novel to actually manifest itself. So what can I say? This book takes place sort of in a world that's deteriorating a little bit. Not a little bit, it's deteriorating a lot. And there are fires everywhere, and it's in a kind of apocalyptic landscape, yet people are kind of going on with what they need to go on with. There are three human characters that just sort of circles around, and they all are sort of dealing with different types of traumas that have happened in their pasts or that they've inherited. And there's also a series of animal and plant characters. So I'm going to read one sort of longer section and then maybe a couple short ones. And this longer section is from the point of view of the old man who has an obsession with birds, who has lost his mother, he's lost his wife, and he spends much of his day just reorganizing the furniture in his house and archiving things and watching slow television. The old man. This morning, the old man, speculating on how things might have turned out differently had he chosen a career as an applied physicist, visits a coffee shop down the street with a large red door and where stale bagels are served, though lately the selection has been dwindling, something about the foreclosure of one bagel company and another bakery on the outskirts of town having burned down in the middle of the night. But the old man tries not to invest too much in the news and simply minds his own business. He has an urge to reach into the bagel display and reorganize the bagels according to hardness, and then pick out the softest one for himself, but is distracted by not knowing how to answer the question of whether he is happy or sad, perhaps an all too direct question to be asked this early in the morning by a chipper teenage barista. And he wants to be given a reason to not give in to death yet, but this morning he discovered that his couch was moldy, and today he had given himself the task of investigating the meaning of divine and continuing a text he had started many years ago. But at the moment, he can't give the young man in front of him a straight answer, and he can't remember what he is doing here with a pencil in his hand, and the letters FNMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMM vacating that one and reluctantly makes his way back home. On television today, there is an hour-long special on watching white rice cooking inside a rice cooker, on watching the skinny, hard, slightly yellow grain sitting in the water slowly suck in the liquid, slowly expand, whiten, then appear as a large, sticky mass of glistening, moist rice. He is mesmerized by the images, by how a process is dictated simply by time and heat and pressure, and how immediately the thoughts forming in his head are of the foundation of a church shaking, and the frazzled and panicked pigeons, and the memory of an utterance, "I've looked there already, there's nothing there." He isn't sure where his memory has been going these days, and so when he wanders out to the balcony to see the pigeons, he can't remember how many pigeons yesterday, how many pigeons the day before that, how many pigeons this morning. At this moment, he only sees one standing solemnly in the middle of the road, and the image of the lone pigeon stirs up an incoherent sense of sadness inside him, a whirling sensation that wells up from the deepest part of his bowels, and as he stares down at the pigeon, feels how utterly tethered to that creature he is in this moment, feels the eternal readiness towards death and the aisle of interconnectedness, which means if the creature is ready to die, then so is he, and that in the form he has been given, this particular particularly human body, he knows not to take for granted the preservation of truth that others deify or vilify so enthusiastically, knows that decisions are often arbitrary, and that one end isn't always an end to achieving a different and necessary goal, that an end can also be graceful and generous or simply an end, and that it isn't just a series of fancy adjectives that turn a gesture into an artifact or apathy into intention. He knows, of course, the dangers of apathy as intention, that the entire notion of being apathetic was also a stern and rigid course of action in itself. And when the world of the past presented itself to him in the form of rain or a pigeon standing in the middle of the street, he knew he ought to at least pay attention. Outside the window, he saw the evening light, sky dimming. The evening, as usual, seemed endless to him, and though he had never really understood the meaning of that phrase, he felt the magnetization of the moon, which had moved slightly since yesterday. And the window, like an eye desaturated by dust and glass, stood between him and the rustling leaves outside. He could not hear the rustling, but felt that resonance as seen by the visibly moving leaves, side to side, swaying, dusty, still warm, and very pale. He imagined himself a pigeon, and remembered the many deaths of his friends, bold public demonstrations on the streets and in the skies, so many winged creatures that would fall from the sky. They had been somewhat naive, thinking that a protest could stop the perseverance of death, that the masses of birds dropping dead in the streets was something that could be controlled by humans, because of course humans always had the tendency to control what wasn't meant to be controlled in the first place. "When I was a bird," he said to himself, before pouring himself some water, hands unsteady and shaking. He paused to consider the phrase, "time passed," and wondered about this inexplicable fear that had been entering into his diaphragm every evening after settling darkness. He ran his finger along the edge of his glass before lifting it to take a sip, to try and settle the unsettledness that came with the settlingness of night. "When I was a bird," he started again, imagining a single pigeon sitting on an electric wire, perhaps watching the sunset, or perhaps watching the people below, or perhaps not paying attention to anything around it, simply sitting in perpetual grace and indignity. A fight could break out below, and the bird could simply sit, an inconsequential witness to an inconsequential event. "When I was a bird, I could confess my memories into the sky." The old man had stopped going to confession years ago. The church had long since closed when the city had started to empty. So too had the church. But also after his mother died, it had been difficult for him to continue any of the relationships that had really revolved around her. He hadn't seen the point of prayer, though in these times of darkness, certain wounds would reveal themselves and he would imagine himself inside the confessional, difficulty breathing, sparrow hands shaking, unfamiliar voice on the other side offering forgiveness for things he didn't really believe he needed forgiveness for. And yet he pushed himself to believe in the ritual, if not for his mother, the tiny bit of conviction it could provide in a moment of uncertainty, a tenuous yet addictive balance to the way he had chosen to live his life, of order, of cleanliness, of light. Those moments inside that wooden box had seemed endless, strange witnessing of dancing shadows on walls and foot tapping against the side, a polished stone in one hand and a dead crow in the other. He was sitting just to sit, and when his mother would pull him out by his hand, he only knew to nod when she nodded and to cry when she cried, an exchange that magnified much of the tenacity of their relationship. He had read a book on scholastic philosophy and had come across the term avum, the mode of existence experienced by angels and by the saints in heaven. It was a state that lay logically between the eternity and timelessness of God and the temporal experience of human beings, or in other words, it was a sort of improper eternity. A strange receding into the permanence of being, but the maintenance of a peculiar distance from the relationships between moving bodies that made time possible and felt, that is, these evenings when the sky would sit beautiful and pale and yellow and rusty against an ever-changing sky, the world seemed to deepen according to a certain time that felt endless yet gradual, imperceptible yet known by color and coldness. His nose felt frigid, and this indicated to him a certain time of day that was known but not quantifiable. And yet these evenings he would remember his mother, and he could recall that it had been exactly 2,721 days, 13 hours, and 7 minutes since his mother's heart had stopped beating. Her yellowing face, the only memory he could see clearly, the only one he clung to, even while pushing her away as the lights dimmed and deepened outside. The perception of color, changing the course of events, changing all of history laid out like a desperate road untangling itself through the woods. The memory of his mother's death, of course, was independent of the sun setting, yet the twisting of his stomach tied these two events inextricably together. And now, during this highly irregular stroll down memory lane, he felt a strange and uncomfortable warmth creep up to where his heart might be. Because it wasn't his mother's death singularly that gripped him, but her death had become the placeholder for all of the other deaths in his life, perhaps because it had been so easy for him to deconstruct and project upon, the clearest lineage of grief that could be drawn from one point to another. Any measure of time also measured the changeableness of choice, and yet the endless evening swallowed any attempt at regret that might emerge, and all he could recall was the scene from this morning, a recently dead crow in the middle of the road, probably hit by an oncoming car. Another crow kept circling, landing on the ground next to the dead one, flapping its wings, desperately trying to protect the body and perhaps ward off traffic, but none of the cars stopped, hardly slowing down or even steering out of the way, while the frantic crow was forced to watch the body of his fallen comrade trampled by cars over and over and over again. First the pigeons, now the crows, he thought. When I was a bird, he mouthed, drawing out every syllable with the edges of his mouth, teeth showing as if he were a wild animal learning to speak, or at least a wild animal being forced, under the restraints of the scientific method, to mimic the words uttered by humans, a process that sought to erase the unique language and way of being of a particular species of animal, and to create a new hierarchy that rewarded, somewhat condescendingly, those animals who could best and most entertainingly parody the gestures of humanity, including, but not limited to, the mouthing of hello, the using of tools, the capability for deception, the recognition of oneself in a mirror. One scholar had written, "Avum is the proper sphere of every created spirit. At death, the body's distracting relation to matter's time ceases to affect the soul so that it can experience its proper avern eternity. But he knew that eternity, or time out of time, did not and could not exist. His mother's body was rotting beneath the ground, after all, and any duration between time and eternity would still fall victim to light and darkness, and at the end of the day, all he could do was wait and watch and remember. When I was a bird, he thought. I used to be frightened, he thought. He wasn't frightened anymore, but neither was the pigeon outside. Stuck in the midst of his world, he smelled the almonds burning in the kitchen and decided to let them burn. That the memories of almonds were like layers of fog, intent and regret rolled into the aroma of nuts, coupled with the smell of burning, of deterioration, of inevitability. The smoke slowly permeating into his room and dancing spirals on the cold glass of the window, masking momentarily that felt duration of endlessness, of time past. And in thickness of the smoke, briefly he felt the sensation of being torn apart and then emerging like having a bucket of cold ice thrown over one's already shivering body, the unexpected happiness of contrast. He could remember something besides his mother, besides her death, besides the violence of loss that shook him awake at night and left him there shaking on top of his sheets until the light permeated his eyelids. He could now remember when he used to be a bird. Outside, the pigeons standing in the middle of the street continued to stand. There were hardly any cars on the roads anymore, as those who had reliable vehicles had mostly evacuated the city, and others could no longer find sources of fuel, the petrol stations having mostly been depleted dry or abandoned after the shipments stopped arriving. There is little more that is as elegant as a pigeon, sitting, its erect posture, the silhouette of its beak against the pale orange sky, the slow and subtle rocking of its body as if controlled by a metronome, existing just to exist, standing just to stand, and yet there is little more that lacks dignity as the pigeon, utterly naive to the other world, one in which moments are organized into previously calculated units and counted by fingers and hands, one in which it is possible to be late and it is possible to be early. Of course, the old man knew better. The pigeons weren't so naive as the humans would like to believe, and yet he needed to feel like a human sometimes too. Of course, in the end, when all the people have perished, the pigeons and the crows and all the other birds will remain, their silhouettes still elegant against the setting sun sky. The bird sits because it sits in a mode in which things can be perpetual without being eternal. Breath enters through its diaphragm, and from the experience of falling in love is irrelevant to the bird, but the sky continues to change color, continues to be present, continues to remain a sky, a formidable and concrete symbol that the world is still here, somehow yet wrapped around them all. The bird sits to observe the wounds, extensions, oblivions, and swallowing ups of the world, the everything else. It understands the patterns of the sky. It understands that the sun sets and rises each day, that it must eat to survive. It understands that in order to fly, it must use its wings. The bird, like the man, is an artist, utterly tied to the world around him and utterly ignored for its efforts. In its world, loss is natural and necessary, but also expansive and felt and momentary. The bird, like the man, is needed by no one, but knows to persist anyway. And because the sky asks gently and forcefully, and because the darkness always comes, it will continue to persist by any means necessary. So I'll read just two very short sections. And this one is the dog. What they don't understand often is that it's not just about survival. It couldn't be. A perpetual investment in survival would be the desire to exist for always, and I understand that this is not the order of things. There is no capacity for always, just the becoming that is bracketed by the first and final breaths. Survival makes an enemy of everyone, but none of us are interested in that. We like to make bonds. This is the becoming that I am interested in. While careful not to let the other dissolve completely, I am here for you as well, for them, for her, for us. What's important to remember is that it's not the loss of the dead when they are forgotten by the living, it's the loss of the living to have forgotten. You can sense what someone is afraid of by looking at their eyes. Cats, of course, project worlds this way, and sometimes they distort the fields. Humans are susceptible to this. Their heads spin and don't understand what they are being guided towards. Chickens are misleading. You can only see half of what they see at a time, and they can use this to their advantage. Of course, smell is what helps me think. Smell is often and pervasive, and it fills a space evenly. There isn't deception in smell. In either case, I'll look you straight in the face. I'm smelling you, but I won't miss eye contact. You might refuse to answer, but I know what has happened, even if you say nothing did. The dream. In a dream, there is a small, huddled crowd of people, their faces bright from the encroaching lava that is slowly crawling towards them from all sides. They are surrounded, and it is obvious to all of the individuals that there is no escape from the fiery deaths. So they do not ask how it is that they got here, and they do not ask what they might do now to save themselves. Rather, in these final moments together, they crowd closer together, not to give themselves an extra breath or two, though naturally that also, but to actually get closer together. That in these moments before death, they want to leave in the intimacy of each other, whether strangers or family or friends. They want to feel what it is to be loved and to be in the entanglement of intimacy with other bodies, the warmth of limbs, the prayers received from others, the tears of terror that transform into tears of generosity and gratitude. And they all grasp at each other, trying to feel each other's bodies, each other's hands, just each other. And as the lava creeps further and further, they can feel the heat from the steam. The skin on their faces starts to boil. Those on the outer perimeter start to scream as their outer layers burn away and their feet simply disintegrate into the mass of lava. The intense heat, heat here is probably an inadequate word to describe the actual temperature of that fiery mass that is about to consume them in totality. For just a blink of existence, reminding them of what it means to feel anything in life and to feel anything in death, both the joy and all of the pain, all of those human feelings as a giant and intense mass before they are obliterated and relieved of their burdens forever. And I'll stop there. Thank you.